Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are on the rise. They say this is the least they can do to express their anger, to express their support to their fellow Palestinians in Gaza, and to show them that they are not alone. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
As India prepares for the world's largest elections in a few months, a research group has recorded alarming spike in anti-Muslim hate speech across the country. The US-based India Hate Lab said hate speech rose by 62% in the second half of 2023 in India compared to the first 6 months of the year. The states where most anti-Muslim hate speeches were recorded are Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh. Considered the biggest voter bases of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party. Other states governed by BJP were not immune either.
It's actually all about the elections, as the ruling party want to retain the power. They don't want to lose this election. They are frustrating the largest Muslim community, and the minority has become an easy tool. They are distracting people from actual crisis the country is facing, and for them, provoking the religious sentiments of the people. Through hate speeches and targeting of Muslims have become election winning issue, especially for large political parties like BJP.
India Hate Lab says it compiled data of incidents reported by Indian media and tracked online activity of Hindu nationalist groups. In recent months, a similar research group, the Hindutva Watch, was blocked in India by a controversial Information Technology Act. Critics accused the ruling party of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community. They allege Modi's ruling party of stigmatizing critics, using laws and enforcement agencies while distracting people from real issues facing the country.
Basically, the present government, who is at the center of the country, basically they don't have any issue related to the people. They don't have a development agenda. So they think that to divide the country on the basis of Hindu and Muslims and to polarize the Hindus, that the best tool is hate speeches. Unfortunately, all the people, those who are giving hate speeches, they are all related to Sangh Parivar.
As the largest minority group in India, Muslims have long been facing social, political and economic marginalization. Rights groups say India's ruling party BJP in recent years have also adopted various laws and policies that have legitimized violence against minorities. The groups allege that mistreatment of Muslims and other minority groups have grown exponentially under Prime Minister Modi, who assumed office in 2014 and is widely expected to retain power after the 2024 elections.
Elections are usually a thrilling experience for any democracy, which experts describe as a phase of transition for a nation's future in the right direction. Observers say in India, it's all about patronizing the majority by polarizing the voters, and religion plays a key role. They say the ruling party's newly enacted laws related to the minorities are turning detrimental for India's secular credentials. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The Yemeni Office of the Presidency organized the first political forum to discuss the political, security and strategic implications and dimensions of the Yemeni pro-Palestine operations in the Red and Arabian Seas. Political and legal experts, academics and researchers from Yemen and abroad participated in the event.
The Red Sea battle led by Yemen in support of the Palestinian people within the battle of the Al-Aqsa flood goes beyond imposing a siege on the Israeli entity and its interests in the region. Yemen draws a new equation and a new reality for the region. Today, the situation has changed, and Yemen is leading a battle that will have major effects in the region and liberate the region from American influence.
Participants underscored the importance of bolstering Yemen's naval operations, which have proven effective in impacting the Western economy, and in particular that of Israel, amid its genocidal war on Gaza. They pointed out the significant decline in activity at Israel's Eilat port.
Certainly, the military operations in the Red Sea strongly affected the Israeli economy, and this is acknowledged by the Israelis themselves. The ports were disrupted, the prices significantly rose, and it led shipping and insurance costs for commercial ships also jump. And this was reflected in the stability of the prices of basic materials and commodities in the occupying entity. Israeli industries were also greatly affected, and the losses were not limited to the economic level only, but included the strategic level, to the point that many Israeli projects were stopped, such as the NEOM project and other projects.
Since the onset of the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, the Yemeni armed forces have carried out dozens of naval operations against Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, imposing a blockade on Israel's maritime navigation. Yemen's Defense Minister Major General Mohammed Al-Atafi has hailed naval reprisal operations against Israel, stressing that the era of hegemonic influence of the United States and its allies on international waters is over.
Experts believe that the ongoing naval operations are not only a show of solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine, but also a move toward undermining U.S. influence in the region. Abu Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Syrian Journalists Union organized a central solidarity stand in support of Palestinian journalists at the General Organization of Radio and Television building in Damascus. The stand was in response to a call from the International Federation of Journalists to observe a minute of silence in mourning for the journalist martyrs who were murdered by the Israeli occupation since the beginning of its war on Gaza. At 12 p.m., all media workers across Syria stood in silence for a minute, holding signs condemning the blatant Israeli aggression targeting Palestinian journalists and demanding an end to the aggression on Gaza and the West Bank.
This stand by Syrian journalists and media professionals is an expression of our complete and absolute support for the Palestinian Journalists Union, the Arab Journalists Union, and the International Federation of Journalists. It is a call to document the Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists, as no other journalists in history have been killed in military confrontations like Palestinian journalists have been.
Syrian journalists affirm that Palestine is Syria's central cause, for which blood has been shed and sacrifices have been made. Today's stand aims to shed light on the systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists by the Israeli occupation, which has killed over 130 journalists since October the 7th. Participants praised the courage and sacrifices of their Palestinian colleagues who have replaced ink with their own blood in the pursuit of the just struggle and the honor of their profession.
These are the heroes who have been targeted by the occupation through assassination and bombardment because they have conveyed the truth about the massacres committed by the Zionist enemy. Today, Syrian journalists stand together in every newsroom, in front of cameras, and at their workplaces, observing a moment of silence. Here, specifically, in front of the Syrian Press Martyrs Board, because the martyrs of truth are the beacons of light that illuminate the path of justice.
Syria has sacrificed dozens of journalist martyrs on the path of truth during over 13 years of its war against the terrorism supported by the West and specifically Israel. Today, Syrian journalists affirmed their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers in their struggle against Zionist terrorism. Syrian journalists have gathered at this symbolic place in solidarity with their Palestinian counterparts who bravely resist the Israeli aggression with their words and cameras. They have unequivocally confirmed that the truth will prevail and justice will triumph. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
On Monday, the Hague-based International Court of Justice heard the final day of submissions on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. Over the 6 days of the public hearings, 52 nations and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League and African Union presented their arguments to the court. The first to speak on the final day of the ICJ hearings was the Turkish representative who joined a large number of nations condemning Israel's decades-long brutal policies in the Palestinian territories. Ankara pointed the finger at those nations which won't stop supporting Tel Aviv despite 30,000 innocent people have been killed in the Gaza Strip.
Those who should do it are well known. The Israeli supporters in the Security Council, it is their responsibility. Indeed, most of the international community is aware of this injustice and is trying to do something.
Palestinian representatives opened the proceedings on Monday last week by accusing Israel of having subjected Palestinians to decades of discrimination, leaving them with the choice of displacement, subjugation, or death. 2 days later, the UK asked the court not to offer an opinion at all on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation.
Unfortunately, the UK came with the political arguments, and here we are in a legal body. Unfortunately, their legal argument was very weak, and we believe that the court will dismiss it. The Israeli practices and measures and its presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful, and unlawfulness should have consequences.
This ICJ case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, and it is different from another ICJ case filed by South Africa, which has accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. Outside the court, activists showed their support to besieged Palestinians during all days of proceedings.
There's also not an excuse for the other countries to say, well, we are not complying with this legal system that we all agreed upon.
I'm here to just show the support, to say to the whole world that the genocide should stop. And this is the only way, actually, to support our people in Palestine, in Gaza.
The court is expected to issue its advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories within 6 months. Despite having no binding force, the court's opinions nevertheless carry great legal weight and moral authority. However, it must be said, the ICJ has no enforcement arm. Max Civili, The Hague.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately, to help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive, to let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Several international agencies are confirming the dire situation in Gaza. According to Save the Children organization, all 1.1 million children in Gaza are facing death by starvation or disease. The World Food Program stopped aid deliveries to the north because of security concerns and talked about the unprecedented levels of desperation. And the UN says that 2.3 million people in Gaza are on the brink of starvation. So what do these warnings mean if nothing is done and young and old are being starved to death as the world watches the genocidal regime of the Zionists and their Western partners continue to kill more Palestinians? But I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Out of Moscow, a former CIA analyst, Larry Johnson. And out of Vermont, research and political analyst Christopher Hilali. Well, thank you both for being with us on the Spotlight. It started off in Moscow. And Larry, how is it that these international agencies can witness the dire situation and even issue warnings about it, but do nothing? I mean, what good are the organizations unless there are enforcement, they're able to enforce it?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's truly shocking. What we're seeing is something that's akin to what happened to Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto and in the Lodz ghettos during World War II. And you would think the Jews who went through that, or at least the ancestors of those who went through that, would have some measure of compassion, some measure of humanity. And instead, they're doing the same thing that the Nazis did to the Jews. Shutting off access to food. You had images during World War II of these children dying and starving in the streets. Well, you're seeing that now. And the problem with, particularly for the Palestinian children are very fragile. You know, I worked my way through college as a respiratory therapy tech. And what we learned back then is that children can get sick and go downhill very, very quickly. So it's important that they have adequate nutrition, that they have that they are properly fed, they are, have adequate access to water, and the fact that Israel is denying them that willfully, knowingly, and the rest of the world, with the exception of the Houthis are the only country that's actually fighting back, trying to take action to compel Israel to impose a ceasefire and stop killing the Palestinians.
Okay, well, Christopher, your opinion that the world is watching the Israeli regime use starvation as a weapon of war, which is a war crime. So what is supposed to happen next with this information? Let's say in this little perfect world, what is supposed to happen at this point? Okay, they're using starvation as a weapon of war, which is a war crime. What happens next?
In an ideal world, the entire Israeli government and all the Israeli military officers and non-commissioned officers would be before an international tribunal for war crimes, just like in Nuremberg or in Japan after the Second World War. But of course, we sadly don't live in a perfect world. We await one, but we don't have one yet. And so as we continue to struggle, we realize that all of these crimes that we are witnessing, war crimes of a horrific magnitude, are happening and unfolding before our eyes, and many of the international institutions and structures are powerless in the face of such devastation and such crimes. And so really, what can we do? The only thing that can be done is the continuing pressure from outside by foreign governments, by populations that are using the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, to continue to pressure their governments, their institutions, the corporations that they buy from, their pension funds, to divest wholly from the Zionist entity, to completely cut off relations with the State of Israel, and to pressure their powers that they have control over to enact some type of change. But you know, with all of that not happening yet, or happening at a very slow pace, we sadly are witness to this spectacle of carnage and genocide before us and are relatively powerless. Of course, we know that the Houthis are fighting, Hezbollah is fighting, many other groups are trying to do what they can. But given the relationship of the Zionist state with the United States and with its Western partners and allies, it's very difficult to bring justice at this point. But we believe justice will prevail at some point. The question is when.
Okay. Well, Larry, as the regime commits these unbelievable crimes every day in Gaza and in the West Bank, it is also experiencing growing pressure from within. Your thoughts on that? Do you think that the dissension that is happening inside of the Israeli regime will help lead to its implosion?
No, unfortunately. I think what it's going to take, and what we've seen is Israel has withdrawn a lot of its combat brigades from Gaza, shifted them a little bit out of the West Bank, and deployed them north on the border with Lebanon and Syria. I anticipate, as per predictions by General Halevi of the Israeli occupation force and by public opinion polls in Israel, that they're going to launch an offensive operation into Lebanon to take on Hezbollah. This is insane on the part of Israel. It's one of the stupidest things they could do, but the irony is it may be end up turning into the salvation of the Palestinian people, because Israel is likely to be defeated and defeated decisively if they do this. And
Let me just jump in here with what you're saying. So you believe at this point in time or soon that the regime is going to turn more of its attention to the north and attack Lebanon directly. They want to take on Hezbollah. What do you think it thinks that it can accomplish by doing that?
They're delusional. They didn't pay attention to what happened in 2006. Heavens, they didn't even pay attention to what happened in 1982. You know, they were responsible for the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, the refugee camps there. But Hezbollah is a real army. Hezbollah is not a collection of sandal-wearing, green headscarf guys that are running around ad hoc. They're an actual formidable military force. Israel, in its hubris and in its arrogance, believes that it can attack Hezbollah and prevail. I believe that that is wrong. I believe that the Israelis will discover the hard way that Hezbollah is a credible military force, perhaps one of the best military forces in the Middle East today. Israel is not a good military force, as we've seen by their conduct in Gaza and in the West Bank. They are undisciplined. They are untrained. They are a group of reservists that occupy, that react more to emotion than according to professional military standards. Hezbollah, ironically, though characterized as a terrorist force, is in fact a much more competent professional military force, and they're likely to crush the Israeli invasion. That when Israel is facing certain military defeat, it will be that which will provide the opening for a genuine negotiated settlement where Israel will have to forego its desire to exterminate the Palestinians.
Interesting analysis. Christopher, your thoughts on what Larry just said.
I think Larry is correct. I do believe accurately, as he has pointed out, Hezbollah is not only a capable fighting force, but they have had combat experience over the past decade fighting against these Salafi and Wahhabi groups in Syria, supporting the Syrian government in Damascus, fighting, waging a struggle against these U.S.-backed forces that were there, whether it be Islamic State, al-Nusra, and all of the other alphabet soup of groups that were over there. Really, what it is now is you have Hezbollah, not only a formidable military force, but a formidable with a formidable military arsenal, with technological capabilities, with advanced weaponry, and with the capabilities to strike not only the border, but deep into Israeli territory. And so I think that this is critical for us to recognize that the entering of Hezbollah into this war fully, not as it has been, very cautiously and, one strike at this base, one strike at that base. We're talking about an all-out war here, if that's what happens, as my colleague points out. If that does happen, the Israeli military is no match for Hezbollah, not only in terms of head-to-head, but the asymmetric warfare, which they are not ready and capable to handle at this point. It is not, some roadside bombs. This is going to be a full-on struggle that they have not really dealt with in many decades.
Okay. Well, Larry, as the Israeli regime continues to target infants and kids, the Palestinian resistance continues to target Zionist soldiers and equipment. Your assessment of the resistance now, almost 5 months into this genocide?
Well, yeah, Israel claimed that their initial goal was to eliminate Hamas. You know, I could understand that at the outset of this military operation by Israel, if they had strictly targeted Hamas fighters, they might have had a chance of bringing in some support from governments like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, if they confined themselves to that. But they revealed their hand. This is not about fighting or defeating Hamas. This is about destroying the Palestinian people. And it doesn't matter whether they're Muslim or Christian. The Israelis are intent on killing, destroying all Palestinians. There is no reason, justification, excuse in the world to explain the deaths of these children and these mothers that has just become the daily story out of Gaza, and to a lesser extent in the West Bank. So Israel has disgraced itself. It has lost whatever moral authority it might have pretended to exert. And, I am sad to see it, but it is incumbent upon the world to condemn this genocide, because that's what it is. This is not a justified military operation responding against particular attackers. This is collective punishment, and that is not right under any regime in the world, be they a monarchy, a democracy, whatever. There's no justification or excuse for this.
The
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Christopher, there's shelling of displaced families, there's little water or food, there's no medical aid, and basically no break for the Palestinian people and no place safe there. And the regime continues to attack. I mean, do you agree with Larry said, is the goal of this regime to kill every Palestinian?
The goal has always been to kill every Palestinian, to wipe the land clean. You know, the mythology that this was a land without a people can only come to pass in reality if the Palestinians are extinguished from their land. And this has been the rallying cry of the far right in Israel for many decades. This is not new. What is new is this situation where now you have these very fascistic leaders in power. Here I'm thinking of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in particular, and their political parties and their allies, of course, who have it as a stated goal that from the sea to the river is only Jewish territory. It's only for the Jewish people. It is, there should be nobody else there. And that doesn't only mean Muslims, it means Christians as well. It means other minorities as well. And so the stated goal is nothing, nothing Palestinian to remain on that land. And so this attack on October 7th provided the perfect opportunity to carry out this operation, which they might not have been able to do without this happening. And so now with it in full effect, we're witnessing right before our eyes, they're not simply targeting Hamas. And as my colleague said, I think that if they had done that, they would have had a little bit more support from some countries that have now turned against them. They are destroying every house, every building, every piece of infrastructure, everything that they can hit, they are hitting, with the stated goal of, we will allow for emigration. We will allow you to leave. We will give you any documents you need. But they know that once they leave, they're not coming back. Just like after the Nakba, the 750,000 plus Palestinians who left, who were forced to leave, who were evicted from their land, have not returned. That's what's happening today. And that's what we are recognizing. That's why people are saying this is genocide, because it is the cleansing of the Palestinians from their land. And the problem is how to stop, Israel from carrying out this fully. And you've recognized that it's very difficult to do because the U.S. has protected it for so long, and because Israel is an illegal nuclear power, and this provides the cover and protection that it so desires.
So what are you saying there with the, Christopher, just staying with you, what you just said at the end about being a nuclear power. Do you think that the regime would use that to threaten, for example, I don't know, the Americans or whom? Tell me what you mean by that.
What I mean is that it's very hard to displace the Israeli regime, that Israel's only salvation is the fact that it's a nuclear power, that if it had not been a nuclear power, that I think many armies would have gone in and would have dismantled this fascist state. Okay. But sadly, because it's a nuclear power, that's its only saving grace by which it holds the saber over its neighbors and the region and says, nobody can touch us, no matter how many genocides we commit, we will reserve the right to use these nuclear weapons. That's the danger of this Zionist entity.
Okay, well, Larry, how much longer do you think these Western governments and their regional puppets can do nothing about this everyday suffering and destruction taking place in Gaza?
Unfortunately, it's all under the Israeli timetable. They're going to launch an invasion into southern Lebanon. I think that's pretty certain. The timing of it remains unknown. Once they do that, whatever initial success they might have, might think they have, it's going to crumble. Hezbollah is going to defeat the armored columns that the Israelis try to insert. And then they're going to launch counterstrikes Hezbollah has missiles that can penetrate deep into Israel that are they haven't used really up to this point. And so they will then cause significant mass casualties in Israel proper. At that point, that is going to put the government of Benjamin Netanyahu into complete chaos because they will have provoked a fight that they're not capable of winning. And even with nuclear weapons, they can threaten to use nuclear weapons at that point, but this is like launching nukes at a point-blank range where it would do as much damage to Israel as it could potentially to Hezbollah or anybody else. So, we're talking a horrific scenario. There is this kind of death and destruction is so needless, so useless, and yet I personally cannot erase the images of these children, of these women, of these families who are mourning their dead and who are trying to escape the violence, and yet Israel continues to inflict it upon them, and they're not carrying firearms, they're not carrying bombs, they're not carrying missiles. It's inhuman, it's unjust.
Yes, I think it's affected, as you said, it's inhuman, and it has affected the psyche of anyone humane in this world by this time. Well, Christopher, what has the regime accomplished with this Holocaust from a military perspective?
They've accomplished nothing. Really, they've accomplished nothing in terms of their stated goals. What they have accomplished is destroying all the infrastructure, killing 35,000+ Palestinians and displacing them. But in terms of military, in terms of a strategic goal or aims or victory, like they're trying to say, they really haven't accomplished anything. In fact, they've made the situation far worse for themselves because now they've isolated themselves politically. They've isolated themselves in terms of the world stage. And now, of course, they are in a predicament because now they've destroyed all this infrastructure. And now what's going to happen? They're going to leave almost 2 million Palestinians in Gaza without houses, without water, without fuel, without electricity. For how long? How long will the international community stand for this? And so what people are saying and what many commentators are rightfully pointing out is that this pressure will eventually bring down the government of Netanyahu most likely. Mm. And what comes next is a government that either will have to take responsibility for the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza and try to open up and loosen the restrictions that have been on Gaza, or they will go in the opposite direction and further isolate themselves and further add fire and fuel to this situation. But I think that this Holocaust, this genocide that we're witnessing cannot go on for much longer without serious consequences for Israel on the international stage and domestically within Israel society. We watched those videos just over the past few days of clashes in many of the cities in Israel and many protesters calling for the ousting of Netanyahu. I think Israeli society is boiling as well. What that looks like will show what the future looks like for the people in Gaza and for the people in the region.
Well, Larry, the regime has said that whatever it does, it's to protect the Israeli regime's security, which obviously almost an oxymoron. But in general, do you think that this regime now can recover or even survive after becoming the pariah of the world?
I think it's important to recognize that even if Netanyahu goes, despite his toxic nature and his terrible governance, that still the majority of the Israeli population support the policies that he has been following. So even if Benny Gantz, who's considered a liberal in Western standards, comes into office, he is going to advocate some of the same policies about destroying and eliminating Palestinians. So this is not... just simply a change in government in Israel is not going to eliminate the threat to the Palestinians. The only thing that's going to eliminate the threat to the Palestinians is a military defeat of the Israeli military. They must suffer a significant defeat in Lebanon, and then it will be at that point that the Muslim nations that surround Israel will at least have some bargaining
power to compel Israel to accept the Palestinians, accept a Palestinian state, and not continue to engage in this policy of genocide, which they're going to follow whether it's Netanyahu or Benny Gantz.
All right, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst out of Moscow. Christopher Halali, research and political analyst out of Vermont. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. This is our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today, we will complete explanation of Surah Jinn, which has 28 ayahs. Number 72 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran, it was revealed in Mecca and has 28 ayahs. The title of the surah indicates that it mainly treats a species of creatures invisible to the human eye and hence called jinn. Endowed with some sort of intelligence and the moral choice to discern good from evil, the jinn have believers and disbelievers amongst them. They were acquainted with the prophets of the past and the previously revealed heavenly scriptures. With the start of the universal mission of Islam, it became incumbent upon them, similar to the human race, to believe in the message entrusted by God Almighty to the mercy unto the whole creation, that is, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. They shall be rewarded or punished according to their specific deeds. The surah ends with ayahs referring to the Almighty Creator's knowledge of the unseen, that is, unknown to all beings. We start from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 23 and 24.
إلا بلاغا من الله ورسالاته ومن يعص الله ورسوله فإن له نار جهنم خالدين فيها أبدا حتى إذا رأوا ما يوعدون فسيعلمون من أضعف ناصرا وأقل عددا.
Say, O Prophet, to the polytheist, I have no duty except to transmit from Allah and to communicate His messages. And whoever disobeys Allah and His Prophet, indeed there will be for him the fire of hell to remain in it forever. When they see what they are promised, they will then know who is weaker in supporters and fewer in numbers. You might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said, God has granted infallibility to the prophets and the imams in view of their highest degree of sincere servitude to Him, and thus they do not invoke anyone else and anything except the Almighty Creator, whose absolute monotheism they preach in order to deliver humanity from darkness and guide them towards the bliss of paradise. The ayahs which we recited to you now quote the Prophet of Islam as saying that his sole duty is to convey the commandments of God to mankind, and whoever disobeys the divine guidelines, especially the polytheists and all other disbelievers, will permanently end up in the eternal fires of hell, while those who earnestly repent and believe are forgiven of their sins. In hell, the polytheist and all those who had disbelieved will see that whatever the prophets had warned about has come true as promised, and finally realize their utter weakness and lack of any supporters, in contrast to the true believers who are the real powerful ones, and against whom these disbelievers used to brag of their supposed power and large numbers. As a matter of fact, the arrogant oppressors will eventually be humiliated and defeated in the world itself with the triumph of the true believers in the end times, an establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice by the Prophet of Islam's 12th and last infallible successor, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him. May God hasten his reappearance. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. Denial of the mission of the prophets and opposition to them is actually denial of Allah and disobedience to his commandments, thereby entailing harsh punishment. Number 2. It is a divine promise that the true believers who do righteous deeds, despite being viewed as downtrodden, will overcome the oppressors and the arrogant, who will finally be weakened and humiliated. And number 3. No arrogant power and its hollow promise should be relied upon, since none can stand against the will of the Almighty Creator. Now let us listen to ayahs 25 and 26 of the same surah.
قُلْ إِنْ أَدْرِي أَقَرِيبٌ مَا تُوعَدُونَ أَمْ يَجْعَلُ لَهُ رَبِّي أَمَدًا عَالِمُ الْغَيْبِ فَلَا يُظْهِرُ عَلَى غَيْبِهِ أَحَدًا.
Say, O Prophet, to the disbelievers, I not know if what you are promised is near, or if my Lord has set a term for it. Knower of the unseen, He does not disclose His unseen to anyone. Here Allah commands the Prophet to answer those who try to ridicule him by asking about the divine promise of punishment for the disbelievers that no one except the All-Wise Creator knows whether the time of the retribution is near or far. As the next ayah says, the unseen and all events to happen are known only to the Almighty Creator, who does not disclose it to anyone. This means whatever the prophet knows about the unseen and of the future is only because God has informed him. It is thus clear that if mankind knew when divine wrath befalls, it will be meaningless to set trial and tribulation for them as tests of faith, because in such a case people will measure and plan their deeds, including evil acts, fully confident of repenting before death after freely indulging in sins and vices. From these ayahs, we learn that number one, the prophet made it clear to the people that only the Almighty Creator knows the unseen and the events to occur, including the time of the retribution promised to the disbelievers. Number two, the vast universe is not limited to what is seen and felt, since the countless creatures and phenomena are beyond the reach of human senses and the intellect, despite their scientific progress. And number three, the knowledge of the unseen is the exclusive authority of Allah, and He grants part of it to whomever He deems deserving. Hence, prophets do not have the knowledge of future and the unseen by themselves. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 27 and 28 of Surah Jin.
إِلَّا مَنِ ارْتَضَى مِن رَّسُولٍ فَإِنَّهُ يَسْلُكُ مِن بَيْنِ يَدَيْهِ وَمِنْ خَلْفِهِ رَصَدًا ليعلم أن قد أبلغوا رسالات ربهم وأحاط بما لديهم وأحصى كل شيء عددا.
Except to a prophet he approves of, then he dispatches a sentinel, that is a guardian angel, before and behind him, so that he, God, may ascertain that they have communicated the messages of their Lord, and He comprehends all that is with Him, and He keeps count of all things. In continuation of the previous ayah, here, God the All-Knowing says that He grants part of the knowledge of the unseen to the most deserving of the prophets, through divine revelation, specially to the last and greatest of them, that is, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Thus, God has endowed the Prophet of Islam and, through him, his infallible heirs, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, with part of the knowledge of the unseen. Moreover, God has granted infallibility to the Prophets and the Imams, for whom angels have been appointed as sentinels or guards. So, what the Prophet and the Imams have conveyed to us of events before and after creation of mankind, till the end times of life on earth, is the absolute truth, having no connection either to the historians whose chronicles cannot be fully relied upon, or to the soothsayers and fortune tellers who are liars and imposters. The next ayah stresses that the prophets sincerely and without the least mistake convey to the people whatever divine commandments they receive through revelation, and Allah the All-Aware has decreed the meticulous recording of all things. These ayahs teach us that number one, God has granted the prophets part of the knowledge of the unseen in order to make them flawlessly and perfectly accomplish their mission. Number two, God has absolute authority and supervision over His prophets who are assigned guardian angels for their protection. Number three, those persons who claim to know the unseen and predict the future are imposters and falsifiers. And number four, The Almighty Creator's knowledge is infinite and encompasses everything and everywhere. Well, dear friends, on that note, we finish Surah Jin. And next week, inshallah, we will start explanation of Surah Muzammil. Till then, God bless you and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.